Hello, everyone, and welcome to episode 4 of the Vulnerabilities Podcast, where we discuss those segments of society which need us the most. As always, I have here with me Ms. Marvi Maimon, former Social Protection Minister from Pakistan, twice parliamentarian and international humanitarian. On today's episode, we'll be discussing all things climate change. The aim, however, isn't to kind of give you a 101 on climate change, but rather to address the interconnectedness of climate change as it addresses and intensifies vulnerabilities. We'll be discussing the link between climate change, poverty, and conflict, and then we'll move on to possible solutions to alleviating this vulnerability through climate change adaptation. It's quite an all-encompassing episode today, so let's get started. Ms. Maimon, what has been your personal experience on climate change and conflict?
Thank you, Laila. I just want to explain how I've been personally involved with four basic climate change areas. The first one has been mangrove forestation. In 2009, we made a Guinness Book of World Record. Pakistan made a Guinness Book of World Record by planting the maximum amount of mangroves. The second big cause that I have been involved in has been GLOF, Glacier Lake Outburst Floods, for the northern areas for Gilgit-Baltistan of Pakistan. And the third one has been, because of the super floods of 2010, has been flood management. I continue to be the Supreme Court permanent rep on flood management as a result of my petition and the commission that was formed after that. And finally, the one that I'm currently most passionate about is climate smart technologies, especially my interaction with ECMOD, is their policy advisor on the same, and also specifically how climate smart technologies can be used in conflict zones to alleviate poverty. And I think as a whole, the link that I have seen with climate change, conflict, COVID, especially right now, is something that I think I would like to talk about in this podcast.
That's really interesting. How would you characterize the link between climate change and vulnerability?
So the link between the two is multidimensional. What this means is that on the one hand, there are very clear links between environmental crises and vulnerability in terms of poverty, food insecurity, post-migration, and resource depletion. Then on the other hand, there's the often overlooked link, which is that of climate change and conflict. Now, it goes without saying that the added layer of the COVID pandemic has made the vulnerabilities worse. Vulnerabilities have increased as a result of COVID, conflict, COVID, and climate change, resulting in more food insecurities and fueling the cyclical issues of conflict and poverty and more displacement.
So could you just tell us a little bit more about how climate change exacerbates or intensifies vulnerability?
The link between climate change and things like poverty, food shortages, et cetera, is quite straightforward and easily understandable. So the changing patterns of rainfall can lead to both floods and droughts. This creates uncertainty in terms of crop cultivation, agriculture suffers, water resources become redundant or unusable. This leads to food insecurity in terms of food and water shortages. In extreme cases, famine may also ensue. And all of this can then have detrimental impacts on the health of vulnerable populations. It can lead to widespread malnutrition, reduced immunity, and even death. So the reduced agricultural potential has economic ramifications too. I mean, already poverty-stricken areas, for example, like in sub-Saharan Africa, the experience has heightened the levels of poverty there. So the UN has identified that almost 80% of the Sahel's farmland is degraded and nearly unusable. This is forcing herdsmen to migrate in search of cultivable farmland. This migration in turn results in a whole new set of vulnerabilities. And communities which are forcefully displaced from their homes are fundamentally more at risk of heightened levels of poverty, violence, health, all sorts of crises. And these people are sometimes referred to as climate refugees or climate migrants. Families are often torn apart in this case. Women and children tend to be more vulnerable to different forms of violence, especially gender-based violence. And climate change creates new patterns of displacement. And in 2018, the World Bank estimated that three regions, Latin America, Sub-Saharan Africa, and Southeast Asia, will generate about 143 million more climate migrants by 2050. Now, these are very, you know, stark numbers. We must take account of this in 2021 going forward. because 2050 is not that far off as such. And in terms of poverty, the World Bank has actually stated that by 2050, it estimates that the collective South Asian economy, which they took to comprise Bangladesh, Bhutan, India, the Maldives, Nepal, and Sri Lanka, will lose approximately 1.8% of its annual GDP due to climate change. Now, this, of course, makes the whole poverty situation even worse. And climate change wipes away people's livelihood opportunities, their homes, their lives, as they know them. The mass migration that I've discussed already puts extra pressure on urban environments. And living conditions obviously drastically deteriorate as a result.
You mentioned climate refugees. That's really interesting. I don't think a lot of us would automatically kind of make that link. Can you tell us a little bit more about them and the kinds of vulnerabilities that they face?
Yes, and especially today, as UNHCR celebrates its 70 years, I think this refugee issue and then the climate refugees is kind of interesting. I mean, this has been highlighted by UNHCR. In 2018, extreme weather patterns resulted in acute humanitarian needs and approximately 18.8 million new disaster-related internal displacements took place. It's important to note that these people are not considered refugees under international law, but there's no clear-cut framework addressing them or their vulnerabilities. So because of this, they're more susceptible to poverty, food insecurity, intercommunal violence, unemployment, to name just a few. And like I said earlier, women are typically a larger proportion of this IDP population. And having to take young children with them from place to place with little to no food, it obviously increases the responsibilities of the international community. And there is definitely an urgent need for the issue of climate refugees to be tackled in a more institutionalized manner with more legal norms and policies to protect them.
So that's kind of the poverty, food insecurity kind of side of it. What about the link between climate change and conflict?
In terms of the link between climate change and conflict, it's a little less straightforward. I mean, it doesn't necessarily mean that environmental catastrophes precipitate conflict, although in many cases they can, like in the case of increased migration, displacement patterns and competition can lead to intercommunal violence. I mean, it's fair to say that climate change can be seen as a threat multiplier. What this means is that it exacerbates existing vulnerabilities, which can lead to an intensified conflict. And countries dealing with conflicts are also less likely to effectively handle these environmental catastrophes. Like the ICRC has actually noted that of the 20 countries deemed most vulnerable to climate change, 18 are experiencing conflict. So in these cases, the relationship is not exactly one of causality, but there's an interlinkage nonetheless. And the reality is that conflict-affected states are amongst the most vulnerable to climate change and the least equipped to handle it. And even those governments who are the most equipped to handle it, even there, the sensitivity of climate change being at the forefront of their policy agenda, of their political agenda, it's not always the case. I mean, now we're seeing more and more countries taking this up as a priority. And after the COP21 and the climate change movements, thankfully, this is now coming back to the forefront of many political agendas, thankfully.
So given all of this, would you say that humanitarian interventions and peacekeeping missions need to more effectively consider climate change when addressing poverty and violence?
Yeah, definitely. I think that there's an urgent need to, to have climate resilient and climate sensitive interventions. And the security concerns in the 21st century are multifaceted. Climate change is inherently intertwined with national and international security. The world is deeply interconnected, and environmental crises are also borderless as such. I mean, there's no border for a climate change crisis. I mean, it affects irrespective of the state boundaries. And so it's important to understand the context. What climate challenges does a particular place face and why? What are its short-term and long-term needs? What is the primary mode of economic activity over there? And does climate change really affect it? Who are the main segments of society affected by this climate change? And there's so many other factors. And climate adaptation, Laila, is really critical. And the more we move towards climate adaptation, the faster we move towards it, the better the other indicators will.
So just moving on to the topic of climate adaptation, like you said, just for our listeners, climate change adaptation requires anticipating the adverse effects of climate change and taking the needed actions to prepare for, prevent, or minimize the damage caused by these. It refers to adjustments in ecological, social, economic, and/or political systems in response to climate change. This can include changes in processes, practice, structures, and policies. The goal is to reduce our vulnerability to the adverse effects of climate change. Another aspect of adaptation involves taking advantage of any opportunities which may arise as a result of climate change. So, Ms. Maimon, based on your own experience dealing with the vulnerability affected by vulnerable affected by climate change, would you say that climate change adaptation presents a global challenge?
No, definitely. There's no part of the world that is not being affected by climate change. We're all in the grip of it. And you don't really need to live in a coastal city, or you don't have to experience the adverse effects of rising sea levels, nor do you have to lead a rural life to grapple with the fallout of reduced crop yields. I mean, it affects all, irrespective of where you are. So because the systems of our world are so heavily interconnected, they do affect us all. And thankfully, this is it's been recognized as part of the SDGs, SDG 13, targets strengthening countries' resilience and adaptive capacities to climate-related issues. Developing countries and conflict zones are obviously more vulnerable to climate change, and climate adaptation is therefore should be more of an urgent priority for them. Amongst the most vulnerable countries in South and Central Asia, what the international community has highlighted recently, those countries are Pakistan, Bangladesh, Nepal, and Tajikistan. Amongst the most vulnerable countries in West Africa, Mali, Burkina Faso, and Senegal. The most vulnerable in East Africa, Ethiopia and Kenya. And in South Africa, in the southern part of Africa, South Africa, Botswana, and Namibia. Now, these are just some of the countries that I've mentioned. Some of them are experiencing conflicts right now. Others have experienced conflict in the past. Nonetheless, climate change and climate adaptation will be key for them getting out better out of this whole process.
Can you tell us a little bit about climate adaptation practices? What are they and what shapes could they take?
There's no one-size-fits-all strategy of climate adaptation. Methods vary depending on the environmental vulnerabilities being faced and what one is seeking to protect, the available funding, et cetera, et cetera. Depends entirely on the unique context of a given region, country, or even, you know, a small village as such. And adaptive solutions can include, could include building flood defense systems, raising dike levels, drought-resistant and heat-resistant crops, setting up early warning systems for extreme weather events, including cyclones and floods, adapting by building codes and design features to climate conditions and possible risks, effective waste management plans, groundwater monitoring systems. The already vulnerable, for example, to poverty and malnutrition, unemployment, etc., are most affected by climate change, like we said earlier. And thus, these very solutions identified here often are part of the dialogue initiated by social protection programs, like the one that I was involved with the beneficiaries of the social protection program. Where possible, such systems are provided by development organizations to alleviate poverty. This is something that we managed in Pakistan at least, and we're seeing that other social protection systems elsewhere in the world are also helping on this front, because what they do is they are the connect between the climate smart technology and providing these directly to those the vulnerable community who needs it the most, so that they can actually not just manage climate change, but they can also come out of it stronger by improving their livelihoods as such. And I hope that we're going to get a chance to talk about this in detail today.
And in terms of such adaptive strategies, who would you say are the relevant actors? Like, who is currently involved and what kinds of climate smart practices are being employed?
Climate change adaptation can take the form of both bottom-up and top-down frameworks. That being said, climate change and environmental degradation is reaching new heights, and vulnerability is increasing so rapidly that there's an urgent need for international, regional, national, and communal policy frameworks to make provisions for climate adaptation. The international and regional teams working out there to facilitate climate adaptation include UNFCCC, UNEP, FAO, EU, the Green Climate Fund, OECD. There's a whole list. So, I mean, IFAD as well, et cetera, et cetera. To give you an example of a UNFCCC a climate adaptation initiative, there's a community-based adaptation initiative in Samoa. And this builds effective coastline infrastructure to prevent erosion and protect mangroves, thereby increasing the resilience of both ecosystems and coastal communities. Now, similarly, in Sri Lanka, in response to frequent periods of drought, women in the region are increasingly operating tanks and wells to obtain, store, and purify water and to use it more efficiently. I want to mention the OECD has a designated task force on climate adaptation, which meets as part of the OECD's working party on climate investment and development, and also on biodiversity, water, and ecosystems. The primary goal of this task force is to help deliver on projects for the Environmental Policy Committee to ensure the country's policy framework strengthen their resilience to climate change. Now, an example of the kind of work showcased at the task force meeting of November 2020 is the climate adaptation strategies of Russia. Now, these include a national system of green financing, ensuring 100% balance between deforestation and forest regeneration by 2024, and the Green Islands Initiative, which looks to build low-carbon energy capacities, develop clean ocean technologies, and renovate residential areas to ensure climate resilience and neutrality. The World Bank, as well, is doing some really valuable work on this front. They've recently launched a project called Climate Adaptation Resilience for South Asia, which aims to create an enabling environment for climate resilient policies and investments in selected sectors and countries in the region. They're also running the Africa Climate Business Plan, which looks to raise awareness and accelerate resource mobilization for climate resilient and low carbon initiatives in the region. Now, if you turn to FAO, they've undertaken numerous programs across the world to facilitate and promote climate smart agriculture practices. For example, they've promoted what is known as the urea deep basement, UDP technique. And this was developed by the International Rice Research Institute and International Fertilizer Development Center. And it's a good climate smart solution for cultivating rice. The generic method of applying urea, which is the main nitrogen fertilizer for rice, is quite inefficient. So it contributes to GHG emissions and water pollution. So the new method compacts the substance into briquettes and places them into the soil after the paddy has been transplanted. This decreases nitrogen losses, increases yields, and also increases the fertilizer efficiency by up to 50%. The technique is promoted especially in Bangladesh. It has increased farmers' incomes and created many local jobs, especially for women who make these briquettes. It therefore contributes to women's social and economic empowerment, which is what I was originally saying. So, you know, where it works, it needs to do that. It needs to not just manage the climate change aspect, not just protect the environment, but it needs to create livelihoods for the most vulnerable. And that's what they're doing. And that's what the aim of most of these projects are. The UNEP, for example, they help individual countries develop national adaptation plans for climate adaptation. And the NAP approach was established under the Cancun Adaptation Framework in 2010, and the Paris Agreement reiterated its importance. The two chief aims of NAPs, as outlined by the UN, are the reduction of vulnerability by building adaptive capacity and resilience, and the integration of adaptation into new and existing policies and programs, especially developmental strategies. So the NAPs are extremely important, and they've been working, and I hope that they continue to to create that kind of momentum within not just at the state level but at community levels.
So in terms of NAPs, what are the kinds of factors which determine how effective an NAP will be?
One of the most important factors, Laila, is to recognize that as in any realm of public policy, here too, there's an inevitable gap between policy and practice. Even if a country's NAP is extremely comprehensive on paper, it does not necessarily mean that its implementation effectiveness will be the same. There tends to be huge hindrances to full compliance and implementation. And comprehensive monitoring and evaluation mechanisms are therefore crucial to ensure NAP effectiveness. And in general, the factors which determine the effectiveness of an NAP include a country's government. If an administration is not committed to the cause of climate change, less likely to develop or commit to an adaptive plan. And if you have climate change as a very active component of the leadership's general rhetoric, and the leadership is actually taking stock of the situation periodically, then it really means that the NAPs are going to function extremely well. So you, as with other things, you need a push from the top, and where countries have that commitment at the top, we've seen better NAP performances. And a country's vulnerability to climate change also determines its NAP. If a region is either not as vulnerable or not as immediately vulnerable, its government is likely to prefer utilizing its time and resources elsewhere. But I think it's something that most countries should be looking into, and where there are conflicts, especially, these NAPs are extremely critical, and I assume and I hope that going forward that the NAPs will be a part of all policymakers' agendas as such.
So you had mentioned earlier that the agricultural sector is one of the hardest hit by climate change. So could you share with us a few examples of adaptive strategies which can help boost its resilience?
The agriculture sector faces huge challenges due to climate change. I mean, they bear the burden of having to feed entire populations and are obviously amongst the hardest hit. Farmers, fisherfolk, foresters are reliant on activities which are fundamentally intertwined with the environment. And adapting the agriculture to meet the need of the hour involves sustainable and climate smart management of land, water, biodiversity. And technologies and processes for adaptation, capacity building, and information dissemination in disaster risk management. Climate smart agriculture is an integrated approach which aims to achieve three outcomes. First, it aims to increase productivity. Second, it aims to enhance resilience. Third, it aims to reduce emissions. And fourth, I want to go into the examples of climate smart agriculture. So for soil management, in regions which are prone to flooding due to extreme weather patterns, farmers should build drainage systems which keep the nutrient-rich topsoil from being, from being affected. And trenches can also help control excess water flow. Mulching is another common CSA practice used to maintain healthy soil. It involves applying organic matter from crop residue to the soil. The second element is climate smart seed varieties. To adapt to changing weather patterns, crop varieties are bred in such a way so as to be resistant to drought, salinity, and flooding. Other qualities include resilience against extreme temperatures. Example, in 2019, the FAO and the IAEA collaborated on a five-year research project to create what they called new climate-proof crop varieties. One of the new rice varieties bred by them is called Guillemar. It is drought-tolerant and is now being used in Cuba, for example. It has boosted yields by about 10% despite record temperatures in the region. The third element is integrated pest management. And climate change has affected the spread of a wide range of insects, diseases, and weeds amongst crops. Integrated pest management is an ecosystem approach to producing and protecting crops. It involves taking the appropriate measures to discourage the spread of pest populations, keeping the use of pesticides economically viable, reducing risk to human health, and disrupting agriculture ecosystems as little as possible. And finally, the fourth one is livestock practices, and climate smart agriculture practices involving livestock include pasture management. This is the production of foraging crops, which is the most important feeding source of livestock. Other practices, practice include zero tillage. This is an agricultural technique for growing crops of pasture, which does not disturb the soil through tillage, decreases the rates of soil erosion. So, I mean, it's interesting that because the benefits of climate smart agriculture go beyond just progress in the way of climate adaptation, and implementing climate smart livelihood programs can do wonders for women empowerment and combating poverty and dealing with food insecurities. And this, of course, it contributes to the UN SDGs. I want to talk about UN Women, which has implemented numerous programs to facilitate this. The UN Women, for example, has partnered with women and organizations in Mali and Malawi to facilitate farmers' access to information and markets and to raise awareness about sustainable farming practices through the Agri-Fed program. In undertaking projects such as these, the UN recognizes that agricultural policies and investments usually fail to consider the difference in resource allocation for men and women. This is especially problematic in developing countries and conflict zones. In the context of climate change, failure to address the gender gap in the agricultural sector exacerbates female vulnerabilities, especially since a large population of women of workers in the agriculture sector are half of them, more than half of them. In fact, in certain areas, more than that are women. This is an important factor. The World Bank has also highlighted the role of innovative climate smart technologies through a gender responsive framework. This recognizes that women are one of the most vulnerable segments of society when it comes to climate change, and that their protection, poverty alleviation of rural women and their empowerment goes hand in hand with adapting to climate change. IFAD, for example, has done wonders for rural populations. There's an IFAD project in Kenya where a pilot project under the FAO's mitigation of climate change in agriculture is focused at small-scale dairy farmers. It looks to integrate a climate-smart perspective into the activity by improving milk and farm productivity and also creating livelihood opportunities. When it comes to women, they receive CSA training. The creation of a tree nursery under the program's training proved extremely beneficial for them. And the selling of the indigenous tree seedlings, the tea cuttings, etc., gave them financial self-sufficiency. So these are actually things that have actually worked. Another technology highlighted in an IFAD study is flexi biogas, which looks at gender and CSA. So it provides gas for cooking and electricity for smallholder farmers with livestock. It is essentially a plastic digester bag under a greenhouse covering and has simple input and output pipes, which transport the biogas to homes or for storage. It's cost efficient, it's easy to install and maintain, and has proven especially popular with rural women. Further advantage specifically for women is that it does not require an abundance of livestock, just one or two cows would suffice. And to go into another project of FAO in Sudan, for example, it has introduced a fuel-efficient mudstones for vulnerable women. And it trained women in Darfur region to produce and use them. This reduces typical global warming-related risks of traditional cooking practices, reduces the amount of fuel wood needed, and it has also become a livelihood opportunity for rural women as such. And this has countless trickle-down positive impacts. For instance, better health and security, and even a reduction in gender-based violence, as women are not required to travel far to keep collecting fuel wood. So, you know, there's many such projects. I am just giving a few just so that today in the podcast, we understand the link really between climate change, livelihoods, conflict, et cetera, et cetera.
That's really interesting. I don't think a lot of people, I mean, myself included, would immediately clock the connection between climate adaptation and alleviating female vulnerability specifically. So that's really interesting. As I understand, your book, Gender Pakistan and UN Peacekeeping, actually touches upon climate-sensitive livelihood activities with particular emphasis on the role of women. Could you tell us a little bit about this?
Yeah, so the book tackles the political economy of peacekeeping, and the part covering climate smart technologies offers possible practices which should be included in UN peacekeeping mandates to create livelihood opportunities for vulnerable people in conflict zones. These conflict zones are sometimes mostly more prone to climate change catastrophes. And so these practices need to be climate smart at all times. And during my interaction with ECMOD, I got to learn of quite a few of them, and this concept of a climate smart agriculture village, which frankly I think needs to be built in terms of peacekeeping missions and really in terms of peace building as well. There are a few needs of the farmers that I want to discuss today. First, there's the energy need of the small farmer. And to tackle this, there's a very good product that ECMOD promotes, which is called Black Gold or the Bio Briquette. This is both sustainable and cost efficient. It's essentially a gas substitute and an alternative to burning trees for one's energy needs. It's a compact of leaves. And this is something that we promoted in terms of the social protection, the safety net that I was leading in Pakistan. And the vulnerable women of Pakistan were able to make these themselves, use them and sell them. So there was a livelihood attached to it and them utilizing it and being climate smart about it at the same time. The second is the fertilizer need of the small farmer, whether it's in a conflict zone specifically, like I'm mentioning, I think it's very important. There's a product called Jolmor, which is essentially a sustainable fertilizer for small farmers. It can be easily produced using readily available materials, including animal manure, plant waste material, and other beneficial microbes. And it improves yields and soil health and drastically reduces input costs. So this is as far as the fertilizer. So energy, fertilizer, and the third one is high-value crop needs of the small farmer. The high-value cash crops differ from region to region. So in every country, and especially in the conflict zones, we've identified different high-value crops which can be grown and which can be sold and which can make a real impact to the bottom line, of these vulnerable communities and to improving their poverty indicators as a result of that. So for example, for DRC, it's unmanufactured tobacco and raw centrifugal sugar, for example, in terms of high-value crop. Finally, the fourth one is soil and water conservation needs of the small farmer. And conservation agriculture, CA, is a very common practice in sub-Saharan Africa. This is a combination of no-tillage, mulching, and crop rotation, which increases crop yields and prevents soil degradation. CSAVs need to be water smart, crop smart, future smart, nutrient smart, energy smart, and ICT smart. So there's a lot of factors, Laila, to this entire equation that they need to be at the same time. In fact, if you look at the recent example from Pakistan is the sowing of seeds to fight against deforestation and how we have used clay balls. So there are many such low-cost innovative examples in the world that need to be applauded and encouraged and prioritized in terms of development dollars. And the reason we need to project them is so that other countries can learn from the experience, and especially conflict zones more so. I just want to, you know, end by saying that there's a lot of low-cost technologies out there. This is a huge subject on its own. It's very exciting because it reduces poverty, it improves climate, the environment. For example, alternate wetting and drying for rice systems. The aim is to reduce water consumption and methane emissions by alternating the draining and flooding of fields 1 or 2 weeks after planting. The second is solar dryer. The third could be, it's a beehive biobriquette. Fourth is a biocomposting. Fifth is eco-fencing. Sixth is bio-intensive farming. Seven is vertical or 3D vegetable farming. Eight is basket composting and farming. The point is that there's a lot out there which is being done, but I think international organizations must come together and perhaps make sure that the entire all the products and all the options are available for the vulnerable communities. And like I said, it's not a one size fits all. So every region will have its own products, its own priorities. But the climate adaptation and the climate smart technologies need to be carved out, need to be part of the policy agenda, need to be discussed, not just discussed, but need to be implemented fast. Because the faster we get down to this, the faster we'll be able to take care of poverty and the crisis that is hitting us already. We haven't really gone into the 101 of climate change, but I think everyone at this stage who's listening to this podcast understands what a real crisis is. And the fact that it's now part of the agenda of many political leaders, that's the good news. Let's just hope that we see more work around low-cost technologies that really, really help the vulnerable more than anything else.
Thank you so much, Ms. Maimon, for such a comprehensive analysis on this really important issue. It's been quite nice to see from your analysis of all these projects and techniques that the international community is more ready to consider this a priority. Because let's face it, climate change is just a reality that all of us have to face. Like you said, it's not restricted within borders or anything like that. I hope this encourages our leaders and even just our communities in general to kind of join hands in the struggle to increase resilience to climate change by recognizing that it is in fact a threat and a risk multiplier, not just for the most vulnerable, but for all of us as well. I'd like to thank our listeners as always for staying with us, and I look forward to welcoming you all soon to another episode of the Vulnerabilities Podcast.